or treading a narrow road between shadowy trees.
I'll tell you, Inquisitions haven't worked out well for my people in the past.
Alec looked blank.
Never mind. Just a mundane history joke. You wouldn't be interested.
You're not a mundane, Alec pointed out. That's why Aline and Sebastian were so excited to get a look at you. Not that you can tell with Sebastian. He always acts like he's seen everything already. Simon spoke without thinking.
Are he and Isabel... Is there something going on there?
That startled a laugh out of Alec.
Isabel and Sebastian? Hardly. Sebastian's a nice guy. Isabel only likes dating thoroughly inappropriate boys our parents will hate. Mundanes, downworlders, petty crooks.
Thanks, Simon said. I'm glad to be classed with the criminal element.
I think she does it for attention, Alec said. She's the only girl in the family, too, so she has to keep proving how tough she is. Or at least that's what she thinks.
Or maybe she's trying to take the attention off you, Simon said almost absently.
You know, since your parents don't know you're gay and all.
Alec stopped in the middle of the road so suddenly that Simon almost crashed into him.
No, he said, but apparently everyone else does.
Except Jace, Simon said.
He doesn't know, does he?
Alec took a deep breath. He was pale, Simon thought, or it could have just been the moonlight washing the color out of everything. His eyes looked black in the darkness.
I really don't see what business it is of yours, unless you're trying to threaten me.
Trying to threaten you? Simon was taken aback.
I'm not.
Then why? Said Alec, and there was a sudden sharp vulnerability in his voice that took Simon aback.
Why bring it up?
Because, Simon said,
you seem to hate me most of the time. I don't take it that personally, even if I did save your life. You seem to kind of hate the whole world. And besides, we have practically nothing in common. But I see you looking at Jace, and I see myself looking at Clary, and I figure, maybe we have that one thing in common, and maybe it might make you dislike me a little less.
So, you're not going to tell Jace? Alec said. I mean, you told Clary how you felt, and...
And it wasn't the best idea, said Simon. Now I wonder all the time how you go back after something like that. Whether we can ever be friends again, or if what we had is broken into pieces. Not because of her, but because of me. Maybe if I found someone else.
Someone else, Alec repeated. He had started walking again very quickly, staring at the road ahead of him.
Simon hurried to keep up. You know what I mean. For instance, I think Magnus Bane really likes you, and he's pretty cool. He throws great parties anyway. Even if I did get turned into a rat that time.
Thanks for the advice. Alec's voice was dry. But I don't think he likes me all that much. He barely spoke to me when he came to open the portal at the Institute.
Maybe you should call him, Simon suggested, trying not to think too hard about how weird it was to be giving a demon hunter advice about possibly dating a warlock.
Can't, Alec said. No phones in Idris. It doesn't matter anyway. His tone was abrupt.
We're here. This is the guard.
A high wall rose in front of them, set with a pair of enormous gates. The gates were carved with the swirling, angular patterns of runes, and though Simon couldn't read them as Clary could, there was something dazzling in their complexity and the sense of power that emanated from them. The gates were guarded by stone angel statues on either side, their faces fierce and beautiful. Each held a carved sword in its hand and a writhing creature, a mixture of rat, bat, and lizard with nasty pointed teeth, lay dying at its feet. Simon stood looking at them for a moment. Demons, he figured, but they could just as easily be vampires. Alec pushed the gate open and gestured for Simon to pass through. Once inside, he blinked around in confusion. Since he'd become a vampire, his night vision had sharpened to a laser-like clarity. But the dozens of torches lining the path to the doors of the guard were made of witchlight, and the harsh white glow seemed to bleach the detail out of everything. He was vaguely aware of Alec guiding him forward down a narrow stone pathway that shone with reflected illumination. And then there was someone standing on the path in front of him, blocking his way with an upraised arm.
So this is the vampire?
The voice that spoke was deep enough to nearly be a growl. Simon looked up, the light stinging his eyes to burning. They would have teared up if he'd been able to shed tears. Witch light, he thought. Angel light burns me. I suppose it's no surprise. The man standing in front of them was very tall, with sallow skin stretched over prominent cheekbones. Under a close-cropped dome of black hair, his forehead was high, his nose beaked and Roman. His expression as he looked down at Simon was the look of a subway commuter watching a large rat run back and forth on the rails, half hoping a train will come along and squish it. "This is Simon," said Alec, a little uncertainly. "Simon, this is Consul Malachi Diodane. Is the portal ready, sir?"
"Yes," Malachi said.
His voice was harsh and carried a faint accent.
"Everything is in readiness. Come, Downworlder," he beckoned to Simon. "The sooner this is all over, the better."
Simon moved to go to the chief officer, but Alec stopped him with a hand on his arm. "Just a moment," he said, addressing the consul. "He'll be sent directly back to Manhattan, and there will be someone waiting there on the other side for him?"
"Indeed," said Malachi. "The warlock Magnus Bane. Since he unwisely allowed the vampire into Idris in the first place, he's taken responsibility for his return."
"If Magnus hadn't let Simon through the portal, he would have died," Alec said, a little sharply.
"Perhaps," said Malachi. "That's what your parents say, and the Clave has chosen to believe them. Against my advice, in fact. Still, one does not lightly bring Downworlders into the City of Glass."
"There was nothing light about it," anger surged in Simon's chest. "We were under attack."
Malachi turned his gaze on Simon.
"You will speak when you are spoken to, Downworlder, not before."
Alec's hand tightened on Simon's arm. There was a look on his face, half hesitation, half suspicion, as if he were doubting his wisdom in bringing Simon here after all.
"Now, Consul, really?"
The voice carrying through the courtyard was high, a little breathless, and Simon saw with some surprise that it belonged to a man, a small, round man hurrying along the path toward them. He was wearing a loose gray cloak over his shadow hunter gear, and his bald head glistened in the witchlight.
"There's no need to alarm our guest."
"Guest?"
Malachi looked outraged. The small man came to a halt before Alec and Simon and beamed at them both.
"We are so glad, pleased, really, that you decided to cooperate with our request that you return to New York. It does make everything so much easier."
He twinkled at Simon, who stared back at him in confusion. He didn't think he'd ever met a shadow hunter who seemed pleased to see him. Not when he was a mundane, and definitely not now that he was a vampire.
"Oh, I almost forgot."
The little man slapped himself on the forehead in remorse.
"I should have introduced myself. I'm the Inquisitor. The new Inquisitor. Inquisitor Aldertree is my name."
Aldertree held his hand out to Simon, and in a welter of confusion, Simon took it.
"And you, your name is Simon?"
"Yes,"
Simon said, drawing his hand back as soon as he could. Aldertree's grip was unpleasantly moist and clammy.
"There's no need to thank me for cooperating. All I want is to go home." "I'm sure you do. I'm sure you do."
Though Aldertree's tone was jovial, something flashed across his face as he spoke, an expression Simon couldn't pin down. It was gone in a moment, as Aldertree smiled and gestured toward a narrow path that wound alongside the guard.
"This way, Simon, if you please."
Simon moved forward, and Alec made as if to follow him. The Inquisitor held up a hand.
"That's all we'll be needing from you, Alexander. Thank you for your help."
"But Simon," Alec began.
"We'll be just fine," the Inquisitor assured him. "Malachi, please show Alexander out, and give him a witchlight runestone to get him back home if he hasn't brought one. The path can be tricky at night."
And with another beatific smile, he whisked Simon away, leaving Alec staring after them both. The world flared up around Clary in an almost tangible blur as Luke carried her over the threshold of the house and down a long hallway. Amatis hurrying ahead of them with her witchlight. More than half delirious, she stared as the corridor unfolded before her, growing longer and longer like a corridor in a nightmare. The world turned on its side. Suddenly, she was lying on a cold surface, and hands were smoothing a blanket over her. Blue eyes gazed down at her.
"She seems so ill, Lucian," Amatis said in a voice that was warped and distorted like an old recording. "What happened to her?"
She drank about half of Lake Lynn.
The sound of Luke's voice faded, and for a moment Clary's vision cleared. She was lying on the cold tiled floor of a kitchen, and somewhere above her head Luke was rummaging in a cabinet. The kitchen had peeling yellow walls and an old-fashioned black cast-iron stove against one wall. Flames leaped behind the stove grating, making her eyes hurt.
Anise, Belladonna, Hellbore.
Luke turned away from the cabinet with an armful of glass canisters.
Can you boil these together, Amatis? I'm going to move her closer to the stove. She's shivering.
Clary tried to speak to say that she didn't need to be warmed, that she was burning up, but the sounds that came out of her mouth weren't the ones she'd intended. She heard herself whimper as Luke lifted her, and then there was heat thawing her left side. She hadn't even realized she was cold. Her teeth clicked together hard, and she tasted blood in her mouth. The world began to tremble around her like water shaken in a glass.
The Lake of Dreams?
Amatis's voice was full of disbelief. Clary couldn't see her clearly, but she seemed to be standing near the stove, a long-handled wooden spoon in her hand.
What were you doing there? Does Jocelyn know where—
And the world was gone. Or at least the real world, the kitchen with the yellow walls and the comforting fire behind the grate. Instead, she saw the waters of Lake Lynn, with fire reflected in them as if in the surface of a piece of polished glass. Angels were walking on the glass, angels with white wings that hung bloodied and broken from their backs, and each of them had Jace's face. And then there were other angels, with wings of black shadow, and they touched their hands to the fire and laughed.
She keeps calling out for her brother.
Amatis's voice sounded hollow, as if filtering down from impossibly high overhead.
He's with the Lightwoods, isn't he?
They're staying with the Penhallows on Princewater Street. I could—
No, Luke said sharply. No. It's better Jace doesn't know about this.
Was I calling out for Jace? Why would I do that?
Clary wondered. But the thought was short-lived. The darkness came back, and the hallucinations claimed her again. This time she dreamed of Alec and of Isabel. Both looked as if they'd been through a fierce battle, their faces streaked with grime and tears. Then they were gone, and she dreamed of a faceless man with black wings sprouting from his back like a bat's. Blood ran from his mouth when he smiled. Praying that the visions would vanish, Clary squeezed her eyes shut. It was a long time before she surfaced again to the sound of voices above her.
"Drink this," Luke said. "Clary, you have to drink this."
And then there were hands on her back, and fluid was being dripped into her mouth from a soaked rag. It tasted bitter and awful, and she choked and gagged on it, but the hands on her back were firm. She swallowed past the pain in her swollen throat.
"There," said Luke. "There. That should be better."
Clary opened her eyes slowly. Kneeling beside her were Luke and Amatis, their nearly identically blue eyes filled with matching concern. She glanced behind them and saw nothing. No angels or devils with bat wings, only yellow walls and a pale pink tea kettle balanced precariously on a windowsill.
"Am I going to die?" she whispered.
Luke smiled haggardly.
"No. It'll be a little while before you're back on form, but you'll survive."
"Okay."
She was too exhausted to feel much of anything, even relief. It felt as if all her bones had been removed, leaving a limp suit of skin behind. Looking up drowsily through her eyelashes, she said, almost without thinking,
"Your eyes are the same."
Luke blinked.
"The same as what?"
"As hers," Clary said, moving her sleepy gaze to Amatis, who looked perplexed. "The same blue."
The ghost of a smile passed over Luke's face.
"Well, it's not that surprising, considering," he said. "I didn't get a chance to introduce you properly before. Clary, this is Amatis Herondale. My sister."
The Inquisitor fell silent the moment Alec and the chief officer were out of earshot. Simon followed him up the narrow, witch-lit path, trying not to squint into the light. He was aware of the guard rising up around him like the side of a ship rising up out of the ocean. Lights blazed from its windows, staining the sky with a silvery light. There were low windows, too, set at ground level. Several were barred, and there was only darkness within. At length they reached a wooden door set into an archway at the side of the building. Aldertree moved to free the lock, and Simon's stomach tightened. People, he'd noticed since he'd become a vampire, had a scent around them that changed with their moods. The Inquisitor stank of something bitter and strong as coffee,
but much more unpleasant. Simon felt the prickling pain in his jaw that meant that his fang teeth wanted to come out, and shrank back from the Inquisitor as he passed through the door. The hallway beyond was long and white, almost tunnel-like, as if it had been carved out of white rock. The Inquisitor hurried along, his witchlight bouncing brightly off the walls. For such a short-legged man, he moved remarkably fast, turning his head from side to side as he went, his nose wrinkling as if he were smelling the air. Simon had to hurry to keep pace as they passed a set of huge double doors thrown wide open like wings. In the room beyond, Simon could see an amphitheater with row upon row of chairs in it, each one occupied by a black-clad shadow hunter. Voices echoed off the walls, many raised in anger, and Simon caught snatches of the conversation as he passed, the words blurring as the speakers overlapped each other. "But we have no proof of what Valentine wants. He has communicated his wishes to no one."
"What does it matter what he wants? He's a renegade and a liar. Do you really think any attempt to appease him would benefit us in the end?"
"You know, a patrol found the dead body of a werewolf child on the outskirts of Brosland, drained of blood. It looks like Valentine's completed the ritual here in Idris."
"With two of the mortal instruments in his possession, he's more powerful than any one Nephilim has a right to be. We may have no choice."
"My cousin died on that ship in New York. There's no way we're letting Valentine get away with what he's already done. There must be retribution." Simon hesitated, curious to hear more, but the Inquisitor was buzzing around him like a fat, irritable bee.
"Come along, come along," he said, swinging his witchlight in front of him. "We don't have a lot of time to waste. I should get back to the meeting before it ends."
Reluctantly, Simon allowed the Inquisitor to push him along the corridor, the word retribution still ringing in his ears. The reminder of that night on the ship was cold, unpleasant. When they reached a door carved with a single stark black rune, the Inquisitor produced a key and unlocked it, ushering Simon inside with a broad gesture of welcome. The room beyond was bare, decorated with a single tapestry that showed an angel rising out of a lake, clutching a sword in one hand and a cup in the other. The fact that he'd seen both the cup and the sword before momentarily distracted Simon. It wasn't until he heard the click of a lock sliding home that he realized the Inquisitor had bolted the door behind him, locking them both in. Simon glanced around. There was no furniture in the room besides a bench with a low table beside it. A decorative silver bell rested on the table.
"The portal, it's in here?" he asked uncertainly.
"Simon, Simon."
Aldertree rubbed his hands together, as if anticipating a birthday party or some other delightful event.
"Are you really in such a hurry to leave? There are a few questions I had so hoped to ask you first."
"Okay," Simon shrugged uncomfortably. "Ask me whatever you want, I guess."
"How very cooperative of you. How delightful."
Aldertree beamed.
"So how long is it exactly that you've been a vampire?"
"About 2 weeks."
"And how did it happen? Were you attacked on the street or perhaps in your bed at night? Do you know who it was who turned you?"
"Well, not exactly."
"But my boy," Aldertree cried, "how could you not know something like that?"
The look he bent on Simon was open and curious. He seemed so harmless, Simon thought, like someone's grandfather or funny old uncle. Simon must have imagined the bitter smell.
"It really wasn't that simple," said Simon, and went on to explain about his two trips to the Dumour, one as a rat and the second under a compulsion so strong it had felt like a giant set of pincers holding him in their grasp and marching him exactly where they wanted him to go.
"And so you see," he finished, "the moment I walked in the door of the hotel, I was attacked. I don't know which of them it was who turned me, or if it was all of them somehow."
The Inquisitor clucked.
"Oh dear, oh dear. That's not good at all. That's very upsetting."
"I certainly thought so," Simon agreed.
"Oh, the Clave won't be pleased."
"What?"
Simon was baffled.
"What does the Clave care how I became a vampire?"
"Well, it would be one thing if you were attacked," Aldertree said apologetically. "But you just walked out there and, well, gave yourself up to the vampires, you see. It looks a bit as if you wanted to be one."
"I didn't want to be one. That's not why I went to the hotel."
"Of course, of course."
Aldertree's voice was soothing.
"Let's move to another topic, shall we?"
Without waiting for a response, he went on.
How is it that the vampires let you survive to rise again, young Simon? Considering that you trespassed on their territory, their normal procedure would have been to feed until you died and then burn your body to prevent you from rising.
Simon opened his mouth to reply, to tell the Inquisitor how Raphael had taken him to the Institute and how Clary and Jace and Isabel had brought him to the cemetery and watched over him as he dug his way out of his own grave. Then he hesitated. He had only the vaguest idea how the law worked, but he doubted somehow that it was standard Shadow Hunter procedure to watch over vampires as they rose, or to provide them with blood for their first feeding.
"I don't know," he said. "I have no idea why they turned me instead of killing me."
"But one of them must have let you drink his blood, or you wouldn't be, well, what you are today. Are you saying you don't know who your vampire sire was?"
"My vampire sire?" Simon had never thought of it that way. He'd gotten Raphael's blood in his mouth almost by accident. And it was hard to think of the vampire boy as a sire of any sort. Raphael looked younger than Simon did.
"I'm afraid not." "Oh, dear," the Inquisitor sighed. "Most unfortunate."
"What's unfortunate?"
"Well, that you're lying to me, my boy."
Aldertree shook his head.
"And I had so hoped you'd cooperate. This is terrible, just terrible. You wouldn't consider telling me the truth, just as a favor?"
"I am telling you the truth."
The Inquisitor drooped like an unwatered flower.
"Such a shame," he sighed again. "Such a shame."
He crossed the room then and rapped sharply on the door, still shaking his head.
"What's going on?"
Alarm and confusion tinged Simon's voice.
"What about the portal?"
"The portal?" Aldertree giggled. "You didn't really think I was just going to let you go, did you?"
Before Simon could say a word in reply, the door burst open and shadow hunters in black gear poured into the room, seizing hold of him. He struggled as strong hands clamped themselves around each of his arms. A hood was tugged down over his head, blinding him. He kicked out at the darkness, his foot connected, and he heard someone swear. He was jerked backward viciously. A hot voice snarled in his ear.
"Do that again, vampire, and I'll pour holy water down your throat and watch you die puking blood."
"That's enough."
The Inquisitor's thin, worried voice rose like a balloon.
"There will be no more threats. I'm just trying to teach our guest a lesson."
He must have moved forward because Simon smelled the strange, bitter smell again, muffled through the hood.
"Simon, Simon," Aldertree said. "I did so enjoy meeting you. I hope a night in the cells of the guard will have the desired effect, and in the morning you'll be a bit more cooperative. I do still see such a bright future for us, once we get over this little hiccup."
His hand came down on Simon's shoulder.
"Take him downstairs, Nephilim."
Simon yelled aloud, but his cries were muffled by the hood. The shadow hunters dragged him from the room and propelled him down what felt like an endless series of maze-like corridors, twisting and turning. Eventually, they reached a set of stairs and he was shoved down it by main force, his feet slipping on the steps. He couldn't tell anything about where they were, except that there was a close, dark smell around them, like wet stone, and that the air was growing wetter and colder as they descended. At last, they paused. There was a scraping sound like iron dragging over stone, and Simon was thrown forward to land on his hands and knees on hard ground. There was a loud metallic clang as of a door being slammed shut, and the sound of retreating footsteps, the echo of boots on stone growing fainter as Simon staggered to his feet. He dragged the hood from his head and threw it to the ground. The close, hot, suffocating feeling around his face vanished, and he fought the urge to gasp for breath. Breath he didn't need. He knew it was just a reflex, but his chest ached as if he'd really been deprived of air. He was in a square, barren stone room with just a single barred window set in the wall above the small, hard-looking bed. Through a low door, Simon could see a tiny bathroom with a sink and toilet. The west wall of the room was also barred. Thick, iron-looking bars running from floor to ceiling sunk deeply into the floor. A hinged iron door made of bars itself was set into the wall. It was fitted with a brass knob which was carved across its face with a dense black rune. In fact, all the bars were carved with runes. Even the window bars were wrapped with spidery lines of them. Though he knew the cell door must be locked, Simon couldn't help himself. He strode across the floor and seized the knob. A searing pain shot through his hand. He yelled and jerked his arm back, staring. Thin wisps of smoke rose from his burned palm. An intricate design had been charred into the skin. It looked a little like a Star of David inside a circle with delicate runes drawn in each of the hollow spaces between the lines. The pain felt like white heat. Simon curled his hand in on itself as a gasp rose to his lips. "What is this?" he whispered, knowing no one could hear him.
"It's the seal of Solomon," said a voice. "It contains, they claim, one of the true names of God. It repels demons. And your kind as well, being an article of your faith."
Simon jerked upright, half forgetting the pain in his hand.
"Who's there? Who said that?"
There was a pause, then...
"I'm in the cell next to yours, Daylighter," said the voice.
It was male, adult, slightly hoarse.
"The guards were here half the day talking about how to keep you penned in. So I wouldn't bother trying to get it open. You're better off saving your strength till you find out what the Clave wants from you."
"They can't hold me here," Simon protested. "I don't belong to this world. My family will notice I'm missing. My teachers."
"They've taken care of that. There are simple enough spells, a beginning warlock could use them, that will supply your parents with the illusion that there's a perfectly legitimate reason for your absence. A school trip, a visit to the family, it can be done."
There was no threat in the voice, and no sorrow. It was matter of fact.
"Do you really think they've never made a downworlder disappear before?"
"Who are you?" Simon's voice cracked. "Are you a downworlder too? Is this where they keep us?" This time there was no answer. Simon called out again, but his neighbor had evidently decided that he'd said all he wanted to say. Nothing answered Simon's cries but silence. The pain in his hand had faded. Looking down, Simon saw that the skin no longer looked burned, but the mark of the seal was printed on his palm as if it had been drawn there in ink. He looked back at the cell bars. He realized now that not all the runes were runes at all. Carved between them were stars of David and lines from the Torah in Hebrew. The carvings looked new. "The guards were here half the day talking about how to keep you penned in," the voice had said. But it hadn't just been because he was a vampire, laughably. It had partly been because he was Jewish. They had spent half the day carving the seal of Solomon into that doorknob so it would burn him when he touched it. It had taken them this long to turn the articles of his faith against him. For some reason, the realization stripped away the last of Simon's self-possession. He sank down onto the bed and put his head in his hands. Princewater Street was dark when Alec returned from the guard. The windows of the houses shuttered and shaded, only the occasional witchlight street lamp casting a pool of white illumination onto the cobblestones. The Penhollow's house was the brightest on the block. Candles glowed in the windows, and the front door was slightly ajar, letting a slice of yellow light out to curve along the walkway. Jace was sitting on the low stone wall that bordered the Penhollow's front garden, his hair very bright under the light of the nearest street lamp. He looked up as Alec approached and shivered a little. He was wearing only a light jacket, Alec saw, and it had grown cold since the sun had gone down. The smell of late roses hung in the chilly air like thin perfume. Alec sank down onto the wall beside Jace.
"Have you been out here waiting for me all this time?"
"Who says I'm waiting for you?"
"It went fine, if that's what you were worried about. I left Simon with the Inquisitor."
"You left him? You didn't stay to make sure everything went all right?"
"It was fine," Alec repeated. "The Inquisitor said he'd take him inside personally and send him back to..."
"The Inquisitor said? The Inquisitor said?" Jace interrupted. "The last Inquisitor we met completely exceeded her command. If she hadn't died, the Clave would have relieved her of her position, maybe even cursed her. What's to say this Inquisitor isn't a nut job too?"
"He seemed all right," said Alec. "Nice, even. He was perfectly polite to Simon. Look, Jace, this is how the Clave works. We don't get to control everything that happens, but you have to trust them because otherwise everything turns into chaos."
"But they've screwed up a lot recently. You have to admit that."
"Maybe," Alec said. But if you start thinking you know better than the Clave and better than the law, what makes you any better than the Inquisitor or Valentine?
Jace flinched. He looked as if Alec had hit him or worse.
Alec's stomach dropped.
I'm sorry, he reached out a hand. I didn't mean that.
A beam of bright yellow light cut across the garden suddenly. Alec looked up to see Isabel framed in the open front door, light pouring out around her. She was only a silhouette, but he could tell from the hands on her hips that she was annoyed.
What are you two doing out here? She called. Everyone's wondering where you are.
Alec turned back to his friend. Jace? But Jace, getting to his feet, ignored Alec's outstretched hand.
You'd better be right about the Clave, was all he said.
Alec watched as Jace stalked back to the house. Unbidden, Simon's voice came into his mind. Now I wonder all the time how you go back after something like that, whether we can ever be friends again, or if what we had is broken into pieces, not because of her, but because of me. The front door shut, leaving Alec sitting in the half-lit garden alone. He closed his eyes for a moment, the image of a face hovering behind his lids. Not Jace's face, for a change. The eyes set in the face were green, slit-pupiled, cat eyes. Opening his eyes, he reached into his satchel and drew out a pen and a piece of paper, torn from the spiral-bound notebook he used as a journal. He wrote a few words on it and then, with his stele, traced the rune for fire at the bottom of the page. It went up faster than he'd thought it would. He let go of the paper as it burned, floating in midair like a firefly. Soon all that was left was a fine drift of ash, sifting like white powder across the rose bushes. Chapter 5. A Problem of Memory. Afternoon light woke Clary, a beam of pale brightness that laid itself directly over her face, lighting the insides of her eyelids to hot pink. She stirred restlessly and warily opened her eyes. The fever was gone, and so was the sense that her bones were melting and breaking inside her. She sat up and glanced around with curious eyes. She was in what had to be Amatis's spare room. It was small, white-painted, the bed covered with a brightly woven rag blanket. Lace curtains were drawn back over round windows, letting in circles of light. She sat up slowly, waiting for dizziness to wash over her. Nothing happened. She felt entirely healthy, even well-rested. Getting out of bed, she looked down at herself. Someone had put her in a pair of starched white pajamas. Though they were wrinkled now and too big for her, the sleeves hung down comically past her fingers. She went to one of the circular windows and peered out. Stacked houses of old gold stone rose up the side of a hill, and the roofs looked as if they had been shingled in bronze. This side of the house faced away from the canal, onto a narrow side garden turning brown and gold with autumn. A trellis crawled up the side of the house. A single last rose hung on it, drooping browning petals. The doorknob rattled, and Clary climbed hastily back into bed just before Amatis entered, holding a tray in her hands. She raised her eyebrows when she saw Clary was awake, but said nothing. "Where's Luke?" Clary demanded, drawing the blanket close around herself for comfort. Amatis set the tray down on the table beside the bed. There was a mug of something hot on it and some slices of buttered bread.
"You should eat something," she said. "You'll feel better."
"I feel fine," Clary said. "Where's Luke?" There was a high-backed chair beside the table. Amatis sat in it, folded her hands in her lap, and regarded Clary calmly. In the daylight, Clary could see more clearly the lines in her face. She looked older than Clary's mother by many years, though they couldn't be that far apart in age. Her brown hair was stippled with gray, her eyes rimmed with dark pink as if she had been crying.
"He's not here."
"Not here like he just popped around the corner to the bodega for a six-pack of Diet Coke and a box of Krispy Kremes, or not here like..."
"He left this morning around dawn after sitting up with you all night.
As to his destination, he wasn't specific."
Amatis's tone was dry, and if Clary hadn't felt so wretched, she might have been amused to note that it made her sound much more like Luke.
"When he lived here, before he left Idris after he was... changed,
he led a wolf pack that made its home in Brosalind Forest. He said he was going back to them, but he wouldn't say why or for how long, only that he'd be back in a few days."
"He just left me here? Am I supposed to sit around and wait for him?"
Well, he couldn't very well take you with him, could he? Amatis asked. And it won't be easy for you to get home. You broke the law in coming here like you did, and the Clave won't overlook that, or be generous about letting you leave.
I don't want to go home. Clary tried to collect herself. I came here to meet someone. I have something to do.
Luke told me, said Amatis. Let me give you a piece of advice. You'll only find Ragnar Fell if he wants to be found.
But,
Clarissa, Amatis looked at her speculatively. We're expecting an attack by Valentine at any moment. Almost every shadow hunter in Idris is here in the city, inside the wards. Staying in Alicante is the safest thing for you. Clary sat frozen. Rationally, Amatis's words made sense. But it didn't do much to quiet the voice inside her screaming that she couldn't wait. She had to find Ragnar Fell now. She had to save her mother now. She had to go now. She bit down on her panic and tried to speak casually.
Luke never told me he had a sister.
No, Amatis said. He wouldn't have. We weren't close.
Luke said your last name was Herondale, Clary said. But that's the Inquisitor's last name, isn't it?
It was, said Amatis, and her face tightened as if the words pained her. She was my mother-in-law.
What was it Luke had told Clary about the Inquisitor? That she'd had a son who married a woman with undesirable family connections. You were married to Stephen Herondale?
Amatis looked surprised. You know his name?
I do. Luke told me, but I thought his wife died. I thought that's why the Inquisitor was so...
horrible, she wanted to say, but it seemed cruel to say it.
Bitter, she said at last.
Amatis reached for the mug she'd brought. Her hand shook a little as she lifted it. Yes, she did die. Killed herself. That was Celine, Stephen's second wife. I was the first.
And you got divorced?
Something like that. Amatis thrust the mug at Clary. Look, drink this. You have to put something in your stomach. Distracted, Clary took the mug and swallowed a hot mouthful. The liquid inside was rich and salty. Not tea, as she'd thought, but soup.
Okay, she said. So, what happened?
Amatis was gazing into the distance. We were in the circle, Stephen and I, along with everyone else. When Luke was... when what happened to Luke happened. Valentine needed a new lieutenant. He chose Stephen. And when he chose Stephen, he decided that perhaps it wouldn't be fitting for the wife of his closest friend and advisor to be someone whose brother was...
a werewolf?
He used another word. Amatis sounded bitter. He convinced Stephen to annul our marriage and to find himself another wife, one that Valentine had picked for him.
Celine was so young, so completely obedient.
That's horrible. Amatis shook her head with a brittle laugh. It was a long time ago. Stephen was kind, I suppose. He gave me this house and moved back into the Herondale Manor with his parents and Celine. I never saw him again after that. I left the circle, of course. They wouldn't have wanted me anymore. The only one of them who still visited me was Jocelyn. She even told me when she went to see Luke. She pushed her graying hair back behind her ears. I heard what happened to Stephen in the uprising once it was all over. And Celine. I'd hated her. But I felt sorry for her then. She cut her wrists, they say. Blood everywhere. She took a deep breath. I saw Imogen later at Stephen's funeral, when they put his body into the Herondale mausoleum. She didn't even seem to recognize me. They made her the Inquisitor not long after that. The Clave felt there was no one else who would have hunted down the former members of the Circle more ruthlessly than she did. And they were right. If she could have washed away her memories of Stephen in their blood, she would have. Clary thought of the cold eyes of the Inquisitor, her narrow, hard stare, and tried to feel pity for her.
I think it made her crazy, she said. Really crazy.
She was horrible to me, but mostly to Jace. It was like she wanted him dead.
That makes sense, said Amatis. You look like your mother, and your mother brought you up, but your brother...
She cocked her head to the side. Does he look as much like Valentine as you look like Jocelyn?
No, Clary said. Jace just looks like himself. A shiver went through her at the thought of Jace. He's here in Alicante, she said, thinking out loud. If I could see him...
No, Amita spoke with asperity. You can't leave the house. Not to see anyone, and definitely not to see your brother.
Not leave the house? Clary was horrified. You mean I'm stuck here like a prisoner?
It's only for a day or two, Amatis admonished her. And besides, you're not well. You need to recover. The lake water nearly killed you.
But Jace
is one of the Lightwoods. You can't go over there. The moment they see you, they'll tell the Clave you're here. And then you won't be the only one in trouble with the law. Luke will be too.
But the Lightwoods won't betray me to the Clave. They wouldn't do that.
The words died on her lips. There was no way she was going to be able to convince Amatis that the Lightwoods she'd known 15 years ago no longer existed. That Robert and Mayris weren't blindly loyal fanatics anymore. This woman might be Luke's sister, but she was still a stranger to Clary. She was almost a stranger to Luke. He hadn't seen her in 16 years. Had never even mentioned she existed. Clary leaned back against the pillows, feigning weariness.
You're right, she said. I don't feel well. I think I'd better sleep.
Good idea.
Amatis leaned over and plucked the empty mug out of her hand. If you want to take a shower, the bathroom's across the hall, and there's a trunk of my old clothes at the foot of the bed. You look like you're about the size I was when I was your age, so they might fit you. Unlike those pajamas, she added, and smiled a weak smile that Clary didn't return. She was too busy fighting the urge to pound her fists against the mattress in frustration. The moment the door closed behind Amatis, Clary scrambled out of bed and headed for the bathroom, hoping that standing in hot water would help clear her head. To her relief, for all their old-fashionedness, the Shadow Hunters seemed to believe in modern plumbing and hot and cold running water. There was even sharply scented citrus soap to rinse the lingering smell of Lake Lynn out of her hair. By the time she emerged, wrapped in two towels, she was feeling much better. In the bedroom, she rummaged through Amatis's trunk. Her clothes were packed away neatly between layers of crisp paper. There were what looked like school clothes, merino wool sweaters with an insignia that looked like four C's back-to-back sewed over the breast pocket, pleated skirts and button-down shirts with narrow cuffs. There was a white dress swathed in layers of tissue paper, a wedding dress, Clary thought, and laid it aside carefully. Below it was another dress, this one made of silvery silk with slender bejeweled straps holding up its gossamer weight. Clary couldn't imagine Amatis in it, but this is the sort of thing my mother might have worn when she went dancing with Valentine, she couldn't help thinking, and let the dress slide back into the trunk, its texture soft and cool against her fingers. And then there was the Shadow Hunter gear packed away at the very bottom. Clary drew out those clothes and spread them curiously across her lap. The first time she had seen Jace in the Lightwoods, they had been wearing their fighting gear. Close-fitting tops and pants of tough, dark material. Up close she could see that the material was not stretchy but stiff, a thin leather pounded very flat until it became flexible. There was a jacket-type top that zipped up and pants that had complicated belt loops. Shadow Hunter belts were big, sturdy things meant for hanging weapons on. She ought, of course, to put on one of the sweaters and maybe a skirt. That was what Amatis had probably meant her to do. But something about the fighting gear called to her. She had always been curious, always wondered what it would be like. A few minutes later, the towels were hanging over the bar at the foot of the bed, and Clary was regarding herself in the mirror with surprise and not a little amusement. The gear fit. It was tight, but not too tight, and hugged the curves of her legs and chest. In fact, it made her look as if she had curves, which was sort of novel. It couldn't make her look formidable. She doubted anything could do that. But at least she looked taller, and her hair against the black material was extraordinarily bright. In fact, I look like my mother, Clary thought with a jolt. And she did. Jocelyn had always had a steely core of toughness under her doll-like looks. Clary had often wondered what had happened in her mother's past to make her the way she was, strong and unbending, stubborn and unafraid. "Does your brother look as much like Valentine as you look like Jocelyn?" Amatis had asked. And Clary had wanted to reply that she didn't look at all like her mother,
that her mother was beautiful and she wasn't. But the Jocelyn that Amatus had known was the girl who'd plotted to bring down Valentine, who'd secretly forged an alliance of Nephilim and Downworlders that had broken the circle and saved the Accords. That Jocelyn would never have agreed to stay quietly inside this house and wait while everything in her world fell apart. Without pausing to think, Clary crossed the room and shot home the bolt on the door, locking it. Then she went to the window and pushed it open. The trellis was there, clinging to the side of the stone wall like a ladder, Clary told herself, just like a ladder, and ladders are perfectly safe. Taking a deep breath, she crawled out onto the window ledge. The guards came back for Simon the next morning, shaking him awake out of an already fitful sleep plagued with strange dreams. This time they didn't blindfold him as they led him back upstairs, and he snuck a quick glance through the barred door of the cell next to his. If he'd hoped to get a look at the owner of the hoarse voice that had spoken to him the night before, he was disappointed. The only thing visible through the bars was what looked like a pile of discarded rags. The guards hurried Simon along a series of gray corridors, quick to shake him if he looked too long in any direction. Finally, they came to a halt in a richly wallpapered room. There were portraits on the walls of different men and women in shadow hunter gear, the frames decorated with patterns of runes. Below one of the largest portraits was a red couch on which the Inquisitor was seated, holding what looked like a silver cup in his hand. He held it out to Simon.
"Blood?" he inquired. "You must be hungry by now."
He tipped the cup toward Simon, and the view of the red liquid inside it hit him just as the smell did. His veins strained toward the blood, like strings under the control of a master puppeteer. The feeling was unpleasant, almost painful.
"Is it human?" Aldertree chuckled. "My boy, don't be ridiculous. It's deer blood, perfectly fresh."
Simon said nothing. His lower lip stung where his fangs had slid from their sheaths, and he tasted his own blood in his mouth. It filled him with nausea. Aldertree's face screwed up like a dried plum.
"Oh, dear." He turned to the guards. "Leave us now, gentlemen," he said, and they turned to go.
Only the consul paused at the door, glancing back at Simon with a look of unmistakable disgust.
"No, thank you," Simon said through the thickness in his mouth. "I don't want the blood." "Your fangs say otherwise, young Simon," Aldertree replied genially. "Here, take it."
He held out the cup, and the smell of blood seemed to waft through the room like the scent of roses through a garden. Simon's incisors stabbed downward, fully extended now, slicing into his lip. The pain was like a slap. He moved forward, almost without volition, and grabbed the cup out of the Inquisitor's hand. He drained it in three swallows, then, realizing what he had done, set it down on the arm of the couch. His hand was shaking. "Inquisitor one," he thought. "Me, zero."
"I trust your night in the cell wasn't too unpleasant." "They're not meant to be torture chambers, my boy. More along the lines of a space for enforced reflection. I find reflection absolutely centers the mind, don't you? Essential to clear thinking. I do hope you got some thinking in. You seem like a thoughtful young man."
The Inquisitor cocked his head to the side.
"I brought that blanket down for you with my own hands, you know. I wouldn't have wanted you to be cold."
"I'm a vampire," Simon said. "We don't get cold."
"Oh."
The Inquisitor looked disappointed.
"I appreciated the Stars of David and the Seal of Solomon," Simon added dryly. "It's always nice to see someone taking an interest in my religion."
"Oh, yes, of course, of course," Aldertree brightened. "Wonderful, aren't they? The carvings? Absolutely charming. And, of course, foolproof. I'd imagine any attempt to touch the cell door would melt the skin right off your hand."
He chuckled, clearly amused by the thought.
"In any case, could you take a step backward for me, my man, just as a favor, a pure favor, you understand?"
Simon took a step back. Nothing happened, but the Inquisitor's eyes widened, the puffy skin around them looking stretched and shiny.
"I see," he breathed.
"You see what?"
"Look where you are, young Simon. Look all about you."
Simon glanced around. Nothing had changed about the room, and it took a moment for him to realize what Aldertree meant. He was standing in a bright patch of sun that angled through a window high overhead.
Aldertree was almost squirming with excitement.
You're standing in direct sunlight, and it's having no effect on you at all. I almost wouldn't have believed it. I mean, I was told, of course, but I've never seen anything like it before.
Simon said nothing. There seemed to be nothing to say.
The question for you, of course, Aldertree went on, is whether you know why you're like this.
Maybe I'm just nicer than other vampires. Simon was immediately sorry he'd spoken. Aldertree's eyes narrowed and a vein bulged at his temple like a fat worm. Clearly, he didn't like jokes unless he was the one making them.
Very amusing, very amusing, he said. Let me ask you this. Have you been a daylighter since the moment you rose from the grave?
No, Simon spoke with care. No. At first the sun burned me. Even just a patch of sunlight would scorch my skin.
Indeed.
Aldertree gave a vigorous nod as if to say that that was the way things ought to be.
So when was it you first noticed that you could walk in the daylight without pain?
It was the morning after the big battle on Valentine's ship.
During which Valentine captured you, is that correct? He had captured you and kept you prisoner on his ship, meaning to use your blood to complete the ritual of infernal conversion.
I guess you know everything already, Simon said. You hardly need me.
Oh, no, not at all,
Aldertree cried, throwing up his hands. He had very small hands, Simon noticed. So small, they looked a little out of place at the ends of his plump arms.
You have so much to contribute, my dear boy. For instance, I can't help wondering if there was something that happened on the ship, something that changed you. Is there anything you can think of?
I drank Jace's blood, Simon thought, half inclined to repeat this to the Inquisitor just to be nasty, and then with a jolt realized, I drank Jace's blood. Could that have been what changed him? Was it possible? And whether it was possible or not, could he tell the Inquisitor what Jace had done? Protecting Clary was one thing. Protecting Jace was another. He didn't owe Jace anything. Except that wasn't strictly true. Jace had offered him his blood to drink, had saved his life with it. Would another shadow hunter have done that for a vampire? And even if he'd only done it for Clary's sake, did it matter? He thought of himself saying, I could have killed you. And Jace, I would have let you. There was no telling what kind of trouble Jace would get into if the Clave knew he had saved Simon's life and how.
I don't remember anything from the boat, Simon said. I think Valentine must have drugged me or something.
Aldertree's face fell.
That's terrible news, terrible. I'm so sorry to hear it.
I'm sorry too, Simon said, although he wasn't.
So there isn't a single thing you remember? Not one colorful detail?
I just remember passing out when Valentine attacked me, and then I woke up later on Luke's truck, headed home. I don't remember anything else.
Oh, dear. Oh, dear.
Aldertree drew his cloak around him.
I see the Lightwood seem to have become rather fond of you, but the other members of the Clave are not so understanding. You were captured by Valentine. You emerged from this confrontation with a peculiar new power you hadn't had before, and now you've found your way to the heart of Idris. You do see how it looks.
If Simon's heart had still been able to beat, it would have been racing.
You think I'm a spy for Valentine?
Aldertree looked shocked.
My boy, I trust you, of course. I trust you implicitly. But the Clave, ugh, the Clave, I'm afraid they can be very suspicious. We had so hoped you'd be able to help us. You see, and I shouldn't be telling you this, but I feel I can confide in you, dear boy, the Clave is in dreadful trouble.
The Clave? Simon felt dazed. But what does that have to do with...
You see, Aldertree went on, the Clave is split down the middle, at war with itself. You might say in a time of war. Mistakes were made by the previous Inquisitor and others. Perhaps it's better not to dwell. But you see, the very authority of the Clave, of the Consul, and the Inquisitor is under question. Valentine always seems to be a step ahead of us, as if he knows our plans in advance. The Council will not listen to my advice or Malachi's, not after what happened in New York.
I thought that was the Inquisitor.
And Malachi was the one who appointed her. Now, of course he had no idea she would go as mad as she did.
But, Simon said a little sourly, there is a question of how it looks. The vein bulged in Aldertree's forehead again.
Clever, he said, and you're correct. Appearances are significant and never more than in politics. You can always sway the crowd, provided you have a good story.
He leaned forward, his eyes locked on Simon.
Now, let me tell you a story. It goes like this. The Lightwoods were once in the circle. At some point, they recanted and were granted mercy on the grounds that they stayed out of Idris, went to New York, and ran the Institute there. Their blameless record began to win them back the trust of the Clave. But all along, they knew Valentine was alive. All along, they were his loyal servants. They took in his son.
But they didn't know.
Be quiet, the Inquisitor snarled, and Simon shut his mouth. They helped him find the mortal instruments and assisted him with the ritual of infernal conversion. When the Inquisitor discovered what they were secretly up to, they arranged to have her killed during the battle on the ship. And now they have come here, to the heart of the Clave, to spy on our plans and reveal them to Valentine as they are made, so that he can defeat us and ultimately bend all Nephilim to his will. And they have brought you with them, you, a vampire who can withstand sunlight, to distract us from their true plans, to return the circle to its former glory and destroy the law.
The Inquisitor leaned forward, his piggy eyes gleaming.
What do you think of that story, vampire?
I think it's insane, said Simon. And it's got more giant holes in it than Kent Avenue in Brooklyn, which, incidentally, hasn't been resurfaced in years. I don't know what you're hoping to accomplish with this.
Hoping? Echoed Aldertree. I don't hope. Downworlder. I know in my heart. I know it is my sacred duty to save the Clave.
With a lie? Said Simon.
With a story, said Aldertree. Great politicians weave tales to inspire their people.
There's nothing inspirational about blaming the Lightwoods for everything.
Some must be sacrificed, said Aldertree.
His face shone with a sweaty light.
Once the Council has a common enemy and a reason to trust the Clave again, they will come together. What is the cost of one family weighed against all that? In fact, I doubt anything much will happen to the Lightwood children. They won't be blamed. Well, perhaps the eldest boy, but the others.
You can't do this, Simon said. Nobody will believe this story.
People believe what they want to believe, Aldertree said, and the Clave wants someone to blame. I can give them that. All I need is you.
Me? What does this have to do with me?
Confess.
The Inquisitor's face was scarlet with excitement now.
Confess that you're a servant of the Lightwoods, that you're all in league with Valentine. Confess, and I'll show you leniency. I'll send you back to your own people, I swear to it. But I need your confession to make the Clave believe.
You want me to confess a lie? Simon said. He knew he was just repeating what the Inquisitor had already said, but his mind was whirling. He couldn't seem to catch hold of a single thought. The faces of the Lightwood spun through his mind. Alec catching his breath on the path up to the guard. Isabel's dark eyes turned up to his. Max bent over a book. And Jace. Jace was one of them as much as if he shared their Lightwood blood. The Inquisitor hadn't said his name, but Simon knew Jace would pay along with the rest of them. And whatever he suffered, Clary would suffer. How had it happened, Simon thought, that he was bound to these people, to people who thought of him as nothing more than a downworlder, half-human at best? He raised his eyes to the Inquisitor's. Alder trees were an odd charcoal black. Looking into them was like looking into darkness. No, Simon said. No, I won't do it.
That blood I gave you, Alder tree said, is all the blood you'll see until you give me a different answer.
There was no kindness in his voice, not even false kindness.
You'd be surprised how thirsty you can get.
Simon said nothing.
Another night in the cells, then,
the Inquisitor said, rising to his feet and reaching for a bell to summon the guards.